Hi, I'm Sean L. McCarthy, founding editor of The Comics Comic, found wherever you can type The Comics Comic into your electronic devices. Welcome to Last Things First, the show that asks comedians about the historic lasts and firsts in their lives as their comedy careers have blossomed, from young people's dreams to adult people living those dreams, or still dreaming. Questions both big and small are asked and answered. It's hopefully both amusing and illuminating. Janine Haruni is a Staten Island native who began her stand-up comedy career in earnest only after moving to London, England in 2012. Haruni experienced her first viral success as one-third of a sketch group called Muriel, whose YouTube fame prompted deals with both the BBC and Quibi. She's also appeared on screen in a recurring role on ITV's Buffering, and a much more supporting role on the big screen in The Batman. Her first solo show at the Edinburgh Fringe, Stand Up with Janine Haruni, Please Remain Seated, directed by the late Adam Brace, earned her a Best Newcomer nomination in 2019. She returned 4 years later with a much more personal and provoking tour about her impending motherhood, Manoush, which earned her a Best Show nomination from The Fringe in 2023. Haruni has taken Manoush back home to the States for its first big American tour, and she sat down with me in between shows to talk about her life, career, family, and what she has learned along the way. There's a lot to get to, so let's get to it! Janine Haruni, thank you so much for joining me. Last things first, you're back in New York City performing your show Manoush. How does it feel to be performing this show in this city?
It's been really nice. I was just saying to my husband that doing stand-up in the UK, because I live in the UK, is kind of like training with weights on because the audiences are a lot tougher. And then you get to the States and audiences are just up for it. They want to laugh. They want to participate. It's kind of like doing a panto in the UK. There's lots of gasping and calling out. So it kind of infuses new life into the show because I've been doing the show for a year now, mostly in the UK, Ireland, etc. So to do it over here feels really nice.
Although, of course, you know, performing in the Soho Playhouse is different than, say, performing in one of the more mainstream comedy clubs.
I know. So I'm doing a U.S. tour and there's a few comedy clubs along the way. So I don't know yet. I'll let you know.
You have to deal with punters, as they call them.
Yeah. And the show, you've seen the show, has some, you know, moments of pathos in it. So I don't know how drunk comedy club people are going to take it, but we'll see.
And of course, the show has to be a lot different from what I saw last August in Edinburgh at the Fringe, because at the Fringe, you were 8 months going on 9 months pregnant.
Yeah.
So it's a completely different vibe to the show.
Yeah. Because the whole show was about being scared of becoming a mom. And I was very much about to become a mom. I think I gave birth maybe 10 days after the Edinburgh Fringe finished. So, yeah, now there's a few updates to the show about my delivery, the C-section I had. I had a very awkward C-section because the doctor had Googled me. So I was like naked in the OR and the doctor was like, I've given you a little Google, you funny lady. I was like, oh my God, just please do surgery and don't talk to me.
That has to be horrible. I'm so sorry on everyone's behalf.
Well, he was a good doctor, so that's all that mattered in the end.
Okay, so you gave birth 10 days after or thereabouts. Were there any false alarms or moments when you were on stage in the basement of Pleasance where you were like, oh no, this might be happening?
Not on stage, but for whatever reason, every single show when I would finish, I would start having contractions. So on stage, nothing. Honestly, the baby was such a kicky baby in my stomach, but when I was doing my show, he was completely still. I think it put him to sleep. I don't think he's a fan. Me and my husband joked after he was born, we were like, if we just need him to go to sleep, I just have to do my hour.
Or he was such a fan already that the minute you stopped, he got upset. It was like, wait, encore, encore.
Yeah, let me out of here.
Stomping his feet.
Yeah.
As you might do in an audience on the floor.
Right, yeah. I think it was more maybe adrenaline, the sort of like adrenaline rush after you finish a show. But it was triggering these Braxton Hicks contractions, these false contractions, which I just didn't know what they were. So I rang the hospital. I registered at the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh, and I would call them and just be like, I think I'm giving birth. And they were like, no, you're not. Don't worry. You're fine. Everyone has these false contractions.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I was born 3 weeks past my due date, so.
Asked your poor mother.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm an only child.
Right. She was
She's like,
traumatized.
I'm not doing this again.
Yeah. Oh my God. She was pregnant for 10 months. Wow. That's
Yeah.
crazy.
Enough about me. Let's go back to more your childhood, right? Because you're originally from New York.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm
Did
from
you?
Staten Island,
I've heard of it.
Florida of New York City. It's weird because New York is such a democratic city, but Staten Island votes very, very Republican. So, and a lot of Staten Islanders retire and move to Florida. So it's got real Trumpy Florida vibes, I'd
Okay.
say.
Had you done any comedy in New York or in the States before moving to London?
Listen, I did improv at UCB in New York, and I was so bad at it, like really, really bad at it.
How bad were you?
I just wouldn't commit. I was too cool for it, you know.
No yes
People would
ending.
make no, I was a no not-er. People would make a big play and I would just sort of be too cool. I wouldn't do an accent. I wouldn't jump in. And every single teacher I had was like, you have to commit. But to me, the idea of committing to something, not knowing what the material is, it was terrifying because I just didn't want to look stupid. But the worst thing you can do in improv, and the only thing that makes you look stupid, is trying to be cool. So I was really bad at that. And I knew I loved comedy. So after that, a few years later, signed up to do a stand-up comedy course. And that was the beginning of this. And that's a lot easier for me. I've said it before, I think, on a podcast, but I like that it's called material because because doing jokes feels like you're jumping off a building. And having material means you can kind of maybe fasten something into a parachute so you don't die. But doing improv, I'm so impressed whenever I see anyone do good improv because you're just jumping off a building with nothing. Like, I hope this works, you know?
How many classes at the ECB did you take?
I did four levels, which at the time was the most you could do. And then I think to get to level five, you had to either pass or fail. And I failed. And I thought, yeah, this makes sense.
Have you spoken with any of your former UCB teachers or fellow students in the years
No.
since?
No, I was so too, I'm too embarrassed to ever even to ever even go back to it.
When you take this tour out to LA, you're not going to be like, oh.
I mean, to be honest with you, I think a lot of the people I did the classes with, because they were the low level classes, I think they just went back to their normal jobs of like, I don't know, banking
Okay.
or whatever it was. So yeah, I don't think anyone in oh, there was one guy who became a stand-up. And I saw him years later, and we were both like, this is better. We're better at this.
Of course, taking classes in improv or sketch is pretty well received, whereas taking classes for stand-up, some comedians still put a big stigma on doing that.
Yeah.
Where did you take your class?
So I did this course in London called the Comedy School, which is more like, do you guys have Toastmasters? Is that a thing in America?
It might still be somewhere, but I think it
Right.
was more of a thing a generation or two ago.
Right. Okay. So it was more like that. It was more people who wanted an activity to do on a Sunday afternoon and thought, I want to learn how to be funny. So they signed up to this course. I'd say it was maybe me and one other person who were kind of serious about stand-up, but I don't think I learned anything in the class. But what I got from it that was super helpful was every Sunday for 6 weeks, I had to come in with 5 minutes of material that I was working on, and we'd present it in front of this class of maybe 20 people. And it was very supportive, and I wasn't worried I was going to be booed off the stage, and you could make mistakes, and it was a very safe environment. And at the end of the 6 week course, you had a pretty solid 5 minutes that you could take out and then start doing open mics with. And I'm a very nervous performer. And I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So the idea of failing in front of a real audience terrified me.
So you say you took this class in London for stand-up. So in between your failed improv experiment at the UCB in New York City
and the beginnings
of your Toastmaster to Edinburgh Fringe Best Newcomer nominee path to success, apparently you were in a huge car accident.
It was before all of that.
Oh, before all of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was too scared to do improv, but I was in this car accident when I was 21 that paralyzed my leg for 2.5 years. And once I'd recovered from that, that helped me have the courage to take an improv class. And then stand up was turning 30, the idea of turning 30 and never having done stand up. So I think I was at the very end of my 29th year on this planet when I signed up to do that stand up.
You were saying something to the effect of there's this notion that if you have a near death experience, that your life has to change, like it has to have this profound effect on you. So let me ask you, what was your life like before the accident that left your leg paralyzed for 2.5 years?
I think I was very sheltered. You know, I grew up with an Arab dad who, anyone who knows what Arab dads are like, very protective, which is adorable, but also gives you a very sheltered life. I mean, just to give you a little perspective on my father's, like, he came and visited me in London. I am 36 years old. And he came to visit me to meet my son after he was born. And he said, "These drivers in London are crazy," because I'm going to start to get my license in the UK.
Ooh.
And he was like, "Why don't I pay for every Uber you ever take? This way you don't drive." I'm like, "You would trust every stranger in the UK to drive me more than you would your own daughter?" So that's a little microcosm of what my childhood was like. And after the accident, I guess the small shift was I'd been cooped up for 2 years, and I think I had the shock of, I'm not invincible. I'm going to die one day, so I might as well just go for things. And I also felt like I'd lost 2 years of my life, so suddenly I feel like my pace, my internal pace, sped up a little bit. So I went traveling. I signed up for a drama school course. I liked that. So I auditioned. I kind of put myself out there in a way that I was afraid to before.
Were those 2 years high school years, college years?
I was 21 when the accident happened.
Oh, so you were just about to
I was in my early 20s.
Get off on whatever your major was. And
yeah, English. English at, what was my college called? Staten Island University? I don't even know the name of my college. Isn't that crazy? I only went there for 2 years because I did 2 years at Loyola in Maryland and then just basically finished my degree in Staten Island, the College of Staten Island. That's where I went.
So what was your idea? Did you have a game plan before the accident?
I think I wanted to do musical theater.
Okay. So
I was
you
a
were
dancer.
Already headed in this direction somewhat.
Yeah. I knew I wanted to perform. My parents were like, "Sure, you can try, but just get a degree in something first." And so I went to Loyola, and then a friend of mine who's an actor who went to NYU gave me really good advice. He said, "College in America is so expensive, and if you want to be a performer, you're going to be broke for a long time. You don't want to graduate with tons of debt." So that's why I left that college and went to just like a really cheap local college and lived at home for my last 2 years.
Did this performance aspect, did this come straight from your grandmother, or
I don't
did it
know.
come from somewhere else?
I think it may be. My dad is a really funny guy and he's a really good singer and he plays the guitar. I think there's a creative streak on that side of the family because his mom was a classical Arabic singer. And then I think he was like the chair of his fraternity and he organized all the social events. So he's like a very charming guy, my dad. So I think it maybe came from that. And also I'm very like my grandmother. I'm named after her. So her real name is Jeanette and I'm called Janine. So, you know, little Jeanette, I guess.
Okay. So you start to go for things and then what took you to London in the first place then?
I wanted to travel, but I also wanted to pursue a career performing somehow. So I did a short course at a drama school in London and liked that course. So then auditioned for the 2 year drama, like degree granting drama program. And then I got in. So I moved to London.
This might be foolishness on my part, but I somehow thought before I started really experiencing the fringe, I was under the presumption or the assumption that most comedians who were expats had tried to establish a career or had somewhat of a career in the United States, but felt uncomfortable in the US and for some reason just connected with audiences abroad better or in a different way. I wasn't aware that people might actually go abroad first and then start.
Well, I'd never even heard of the Fringe before. And I went to drama school not thinking I was going to do comedy. I went thinking I was going to be a serious stage performer and do Shakespeare. And when I graduated drama school, I got cast in a very serious West End adaptation of 1984. And I thought, this is going to be my path. I'm a serious actress. And after, I think, 300 performances of that show, I thought, this is so boring. You're just saying the same thing over and over again. There's very little creativity when you're a stage actor. The director tells you everything, where to stand, what to say, what to wear. And so that's when I started doing sketches with, I had a sketch group for a while called Muriel, two girlfriends of mine that I met in drama school. So yeah, we started making these sketches. We put them online. It was like the dawn of YouTube sketches where a sketch could be 4.5 minutes long and people would watch it, you know?
Did any of those videos take off or?
Yeah, they all did. I think our first video got 1.5 million views on YouTube or something like that. One of the last ones that we did got 100 million views.
What was your sketch group called?
Muriel.
Muriel.
Yeah, we only did one Edinburgh. We did lots of video stuff because my husband is a director and just filmed everything for us and edited all together. And it's so hard with sketch when you go to the Fringe. It's so expensive and you're splitting it with three people, splitting all your earnings with three people or whatever, however big your group is. And everything just lives and dies in that 1 month. So to record stuff and put it online seemed to be the wisest choice for us because it would last forever, you know?
And sketch requires more tech too.
Yeah, exactly. There was costume changes and lights, and my husband did this whole like video, interactive video thing that was part of it.
Did Muriel, did your group have any discussions with TV outlets or with
Yeah, when
major
our
web
first
companies or corporate sponsorships or anything like that?
Yeah, oh my God. We once did, oh my God, this like investment company messaged us and said, we want to make these training videos, but we want them to be funny. So would your sketch group be interested? And then I think they paid us more money than I had like ever earned. They paid us more money in a month than I'd earned like in a year previous to that. So we were like, yeah, absolutely. But this investment company, all of their financial planners were men, and they'd hired three women, me and my sketch group, to perform. And so instead of having us act as financial planners as women, they made us dress as men. They thought it was more realistic to see three women dressed as men as financial planners than the idea that a woman could be a financial planner. So that was fine. We recorded the sketches and, you know, we're wearing like funny mustaches and stuff. And that was whatever. But then they made us do a live aspect of it where we had to come in and like meet real financial planners. So I had to walk. So it was the sketches we were doing. It was Meg and Sally, who were in my group. They both looked like normal women in business clothes. And then I'm the shortest person in our group by like a foot. These girls are very tall and I'm very short. I'm about a foot shorter than the two of them. I'm wearing a fake mustache, a man's wig, men's clothes, and inexplicably, for some reason, my name is Pierre. I had to walk into this group of men who are around my age and are like men I could potentially date in my life at some point, dressed as a man. And then I had to stand in front of them and be like, hello, my name's Pierre. I'm 56 years old. I want to invest my money in, I'm not sure. Like, I had to do this whole spiel. Honestly, it was so embarrassing. At one point, Meg in the group had to slap me in the face before we went out because I just could not stop laughing. That was our big corporate event story.
The money wasn't so alluring that you decided to become fully like corporate comic.
To be honest with you, they never invited us back, and I completely understand why. It was
So,
awful.
was there a natural split of the group,
Yeah,
or?
when we started writing, we pitched our sketches did really well online. I think to this day, I think we have the most views of any UK sketch group. I think we have maybe 150,000, no, 100, 150 million views total or something.
Take that, John Cleese.
We worked with BBC. They were doing this sort of online thing for a while where they would pay sketch groups abysmally and you would make these little sketches that they'd put up on their social platforms. We did that for a while. And then do you remember Quibi?
Yes, that's
We were,
recent.
yeah, so we were, that was sort of the end for us because we'd spent maybe 2 months. I don't know. I can't remember. I think they'd said they were going to make a sketch show with us. So we did this whole pitch. We wrote all the sketches. They sent us the development money. And then we worked on that for about a month, wrote all these sketches, sent them off. And then Quibi obviously went under when the pandemic happened. I mean,
Yeah.
the whole idea of that platform was just quick little bite-sized shorts that you can watch while you're running around. And then lockdown happened. So.
Thank you for explaining Quibi to our listeners
I can't imagine that most
who
people
might
will
have already
remember.
forgotten that it was a thing.
I don't know anyone outside the industry who's ever even heard of Quibi.
Okay, but Quibi was that was 2019, which was the same year that you brought your first solo show to the Fringe. So you were
Yeah.
still doing the sketch stuff at the same time as you were embarking on your
Yeah,
solo
yeah.
career.
So I think it was the end of the Fringe. I'd flown home to New York and I think as soon as I got off the plane, I opened my email and I saw this email that said we'd been given this development money by Quibi. They want to make a show with us. And I thought, I've made it. That's it. And obviously that all fell apart. And then the pandemic happened. So my stand-up career took a 2-year hiatus as well. So yeah, you never know what's coming down the pipeline for you.
What do you've had two major experiences with the Fringe, and both times you make the short list. What has been your experience with Edinburgh that you think you can pass along to people in terms of like how to navigate a festival that has 3,500 shows or something like that?
I think only do it if you feel like you have a show that can stand out in some way, whether the top you're offering a new perspective, it's a topic that people haven't spoken about before. I think it's so easy to get lost in, the absolute tidal wave of shows that are out there. So I think financially, it costs so much money to go up there. I think only do it if you feel like you are saying something or doing something that hasn't been said or done before. And if not, and you're a really funny comedian, just spend your money recording your clips and put them out online and build an audience like that. I really think the Fringe is gonna go under because it can't sustain the way that it is. The model is insane. No performers ever make money when they go up there. It's so expensive to rent a place to stay. It's so expensive to hire a venue, and then you have to hire a flyering team and all of the print advertising. It costs people like 10 grand to go up there, and you can just spend 10 grand to film a special somewhere and then put that online, and then you have that forever. So I would proceed with caution, would be my advice.
Yeah, well, just from your own personal perspective, then, what was the difference between going to the Fringe in 2019 versus going back in 2023? I mean, I know there are some big differences, such as being pregnant and Adam, which we'll get to, but just even those two issues aside, when you talk about the costs of navigating the Fringe or promoting your show, did you see any tangible differences in those between those 4 years?
Well, luckily, both times that I went up, I had a producer who had paid for it, which is very rare. Soho Theatre, which are they're an amazing theatre in London and production company. They are, I think, funded by the government. They get a sort of government grant for culture, I guess. So they funded my first Fringe, which was unbelievable. And then I had an amazing producer on my second Fringe called Show and Tell, and they helped to pay for that. So that was good. If you can get a producer who can pay for your expenses, do that. The major difference that I noticed is that in 2019, when I was nominated for Best Newcomer, lots of people knew what that award was. And by the time I went back in 2023 and got nominated for Best Show, I would say that the award means a lot less these days because of the rise of internet comedy. Because now there's a whole new generation of people who are coming to watch comedy as audience members because they're finding people that they like online. So they're not a comedy crowd that's coming, which is amazing and great, but they don't know anything about the Edinburgh Fringe. They don't know what the awards mean, or they don't really care about reviews. So
Wait, what? They don't care about
they
reviews?
don't care about reviews, I'm sorry to say.
I might as well take away all my stars now. Take my stars and go home.
Yeah. So that's the major difference. And I noticed that when I went out on tour, most people had come to see my show because they saw me on Instagram rather than because I think in 2019, people made an effort to come out because they like to see all the shows that got nominated. And in 2023, I think it was people who had found me on the internet.
So that explains why you made that video with your dad the other day.
Oh my God. We had to record that like 20 times. He was perfect every time, but I just could not keep it together. And we had to cross a street. And so many times we were like nearly hit by a car. And I was like, not again. Fool me once, you know?
So, the late director Adam Brace, how did he enter your world?
So I did, look, I love a course. So I did this course at Soho Theatre. It was a stand-up course for people who'd been doing stand-up for about a year who wanted to start writing their first show. And I think it was maybe the third week, this guy walked in. He was very well dressed, very obviously hungover. I didn't like him. He seemed very smug. And one by one, we all got up and had to do a 3-minute set in front of him. I did my bit. He kind of said, I don't think that's going to work. And I'm like, yeah, it works. And he's like, no, it's not going to work. And I'm like, I've done it. It works. And we had this little argument. And then we left. And I said to my husband, well, that guy thinks he knows everything. And then my husband was like, do you know who that is? He directed those two shows at the Fringe, Alex Edelman's Just for Us and Alfie Brown's Lunatic, that you loved last year. And I was like, oh no, he does know things. So I sent him this very humble email where I was like, I absolutely loved the shows that you did at the Fringe, and I think you're a genius. And if there was any way that you would talk to me about working on my show, I would really appreciate it. And he sent me a message back and said, I liked that you argued back with me, and I'd love to have a meeting. And that was it.
So what did he do for you and Manoush?
With the new show?
Yeah.
I think in order to talk about that, I'd have to talk about my first show, which is he just taught me how to write our long form comedy.
Okay.
He taught me the importance of establishing characters, of creating narrative threads, of tying them together. I love writing jokes, and he showed me that jokes are really just the bricks that you're using to build something bigger. And so when we worked on Manouche, I think he only came to one preview, and we had maybe three note sessions before he got sick and was in the hospital. But the reason that I still say on the poster that it's directed by him and then John Britton, who came on maybe the month before the Fringe to help sort of piece everything together, John is also amazing and a complete genius. Is because everything that's in that show is stuff that I learned from Adam.
How it is such a different skill set to put together a cohesive hour at the fringe versus what you typically see in America, which are hours that just happen to be hodgepodge of material
Yeah,
that
maybe they're
they
thematically
might have
linked.
callbacks and things like
Very
that, but
rare.
it's
Don't you find that it's really rare for American comics to do callbacks? I see them so much in the UK, but I rarely see it in the US. Or if they do, there's just one at the very end. It's like the
yeah.
last joke, you know?
Right. Maybe not as much as I used to see 20 years ago.
Right. Okay. Maybe it's just kind of gone out of fashion.
I think it's, I want to say it's because Americans are taught to build their sets in 5 or 10 or 15 minute chunks,
Yeah,
and
I
then they
think you're
figure out, well,
right.
how does this go together?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think an hour is probably just 3 20-minute sets that they've worked on, and it's only
Yeah.
once they start touring it that they can link it together, really.
Right. I'm also struck by something you said earlier when you talked about how you were so scared of improv and how it feels like that almost parallels your being scared of motherhood. It's
Yeah.
this sense of
I'm
like,
scared of a
well, I
lot
want
of
the
things.
material. Like, I need the material. No one's given me the material because motherhood really is the biggest improv job
Oh my God,
in
you're
your life
completely
is you.
winging it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to yes and that baby.
Oh my God,
I mean,
all the
you can
time.
block the suggestion, sure, but it's gonna be a lot
I'll tell
rougher,
you
right?
what, this baby is a terrible improv partner. He's giving me very little feedback at the moment. It's a lot of crying, and I don't know what he needs, and it's a lot of guesswork. But we're figuring it out. The main thing is the lack of sleep. When people said you're going to be more tired than you have been in your entire life, I didn't understand what they meant. But having a kid means you just don't, you just, I never thought I'd ever utter the sentence, yeah, I had a good night's sleep. I got a solid 5 hours last night. But that's what it is when you have a kid.
Right. And you're trying to mount a big American tour.
Yeah. Luckily, my husband is amazing, and I couldn't do it without him. I know a lot of my friends have husbands who they feel like they couldn't leave their baby with, but he's more of a mom than I am, I have to say.
And I know you talked a lot about your stand-up and your sketch stuff, but you have, even though Quibi didn't work out, you have had this other stuff, whether it was buffering on ITV or you had
Yeah.
a small role in The Batman.
Yeah.
Where do you see things going from here? Or do you have a new game plan or?
I don't know. I mean, I'm planning on the show that I'm touring now. I'm planning on self-funding a taping of it and either trying to sell it to a streamer or releasing it on YouTube, because I don't like the feeling of not knowing. I like to have a little bit of control, and in the career in the arts, it's like you have no control over anything. So that's the immediate goal. And beyond that, I don't really know. You know, I think I just want to keep making stuff that I'm proud of, and once in a while landing a voiceover for Oreo and taking a little bit of money home to feed my kid. That's the dream. That's the goal.
Well, Nabisco, if you're listening,
Yeah.
you know where to find Janine. She's at the Soho Playhouse, and then she's on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jeannie. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was so nice chatting.
This episode of The Comics Comic Presents Last Things First was post-produced by Alex Brazell at Showbiz Studios. Theme music was by Camille Harris and Shockwave, logo by Giggle Chick. If you enjoyed listening, please check out my Substack called Piffany at piffany.substack.com for transcripts, bonus commentary, and expert analysis about comedy, show business, and more. I'm your host, Sean L. McCarthy. Thanks for listening!